Welcome, and thank you for listening to Grace Heritage Church Audio, building a household of faith on a foundation of grace. Visit us online at graceheritage.org. Please stay tuned after the message for more information. Thank you.
In our culture particularly, it's easy to forsake the assembling of ourselves together. In the times of the people who first received this letter to the Hebrews, it was easy for them to forsake it because they were being persecuted if they came together. For us, it's a different reason, but nevertheless, it's still easy for us to habitually neglect the spiritual discipline of meeting together in certain ways and of the benefits of it. Once again, I'd remind you of these disciplines of withdrawal and these disciplines of engagement. Some spiritual disciplines are to be we practice when we withdraw from all others. And others, like koinonia, require the presence of other people. An intentional, disciplined engagement with people for these things. But be warned that just about every cultural trend we have makes it harder for us to spend time together talking about God and the things of God. Everything we buy virtually and the way we buy it, even the way we've come to buy gasoline, pulls us away from people. And many of the things we do buy in person, it's often at big box stores where you see, if you can find someone to help you, it's someone you've never seen in your life. And if you have problems with the product you bought and you go back there, you can't find the person again that you dealt with. It's going to be someone completely different, maybe with green hair this time, but someone you've never seen in your life. In trying to counteract this trend, back when I was still living in Kansas City, I attempted to stop going to a big box store and go to a local hardware store. Prices were a little more expensive there, but I got service. As soon as I came in the door, someone would speak to me. And I got to know Bud, who was one of the longtime employees there. And he would ask me what I needed. He would take me to where it was. He said, "You know how to use this?" "No, I have no idea." He would take it out of the box and show me how to do this. And I only got that kind of attention at those places where I shop face-to-face from people that I came to know. I also got to know about his life and eventually was able to talk with him about the things of God, which I never would have done in a big box store where I'm not even sure I would have contact with someone. And if I did, it would be someone I'd probably never see again. So there is this intentionality about this. It is a discipline. And similarly, in the church, there has to be an intentionality as never before. Because every cultural trend is working to keep us apart, and so that now living in such a disconnected world becomes normal. It is the norm to get things over the internet, over the phone, or it is the norm. In fact, you'd have to say, how often do I actually buy something from someone I know? How much of my daily commerce is actually from people that I know? Not necessarily that someone you already knew beforehand, but it's someone you've come to know. Because whenever you go there, it's the same person that you see. And if that's normal life, then it becomes normal to have those same kind of relationships at church. All life is disconnected, so when you come to church, it's normal to be disconnected. And that's not healthy. But it's the way that our culture pushes us actually away from each other. And therefore, koinonia, the thing I'm talking about here, must become a discipline. Because otherwise, we can live all of our lives without really having to talk to people about things that really matter. And that leads us to the temptation then of forsaking the assembling of ourselves together. When I lived again in Kansas City, most people that lived around me were people I really never even got to know. There was a couple that for 10 years, they slept 100 feet from me. For 10 years. And if he walked in that door, I wouldn't know him. because of our progress, people could drive past my house, pull in the driveway, press the magic button, and the door to their castle, the gate to their castle, permits them entrance. They press the button, and entrance is withdrawn, and no one can come into their castle. And they don't come out of there until they come roaring out the next day. And I had one neighbor that even on weekends when he's at home, he never came out of the house except to go to the mailbox. He didn't have to. He hired someone to mow his yard. And all of his entertainment and comforts were inside. Cable television, internet, all the entertainment was there. And it was cooler in the summer inside and warmer in the winter. But there used to be a time where you would go outside for both of those things. It was cooler on the front porch than in the house. And that was entertainment. As neighbors walked by, people would chat with their neighbors, or they would listen. If you've read John Grisham's book, A Painted House, they would listen to the Cardinals baseball game out on the front porch on the radio, or read the paper outside or whatever. Entertainment was outside, and it was, the climate was better outside in many cases. But then because of progress, we stayed inside for those things. The entertainment was inside. First with the radio, because you'd have to take the radio outside. Otherwise, especially when the first radios came out, you know, the big honking radios with, you know, 463 knobs, of which two worked, on-off volume and the channel selector, you know. And you go inside and listen to the radio, your entertainment. Then television, same thing. And then because climate control, you don't have to go outside where it's cooler because of air conditioning. It's cooler inside. Now, who wants to be without those things? Who doesn't want air conditioning in Auburn, Alabama? Who wants to be apart from those things? Right now, you know, when you got a weather crisis and so forth, you're glad to have the ability to, you know, see that coming and know what's going to happen if the tornado is close. Now they have the technology to say it's tornado is heading your direction and it's going to be there in 12 minutes. That sort of thing. That can save your life. We're grateful for those things. But that means that you can live next door to someone and never see them because they don't have to go outside. We like the progress, but there's a downside. There's a book called Why Things Bite Back, The Unintended Consequences of Technology, that we like the benefits, but we need to realize the cost. And the younger you are, the more you need to be awakened to these costs. That world you're used to is not necessarily the real world, at least in terms of relationships, that you need to take the red pill and wake up to that. Those of you who are most susceptible to me to this know what I mean by that. Others of you going, the red pill, what are you talking about? Well, you don't need to hear this right now. You need to take the red pill and wake up and realize the world that I've been cocooned in, the world I'm used to, is not the real world. But the real world involves face-to-face relationships with people. And that I have to get out of that world sometimes. I have to discipline myself to be face-to-face with people, that's the real world, flesh and blood people, not disembodied people on a screen. In fact, let me show you this. In 2 John and 3 John, this is not exactly what we would call a high-tech world. For us, in our world, you can't get any more personal than a handwritten letter. If you get a handwritten letter, you realize, I mean, that's, people save those things. You realize they took the time to do that. They didn't just type it, but they wrote it by hand. And with no penmanship classes anymore in school, if you can even read it, you tend to save those things. I mean, many of you, especially the younger you are, you can hardly remember getting a real letter. But those are kinds of things that people actually save because they're so rare, and it speaks of a personal touch. One of the reasons I like to use a real pen, you know, a man's pen. Gets ink from a bottle. If it doesn't get ink from a bottle, it's not a real pen. It's just an inky paste spreading stick. But people comment all the time on that. At the seminary, you know, I'm writing personal notes and so forth, and that just people remark on it because it's so exceptional. In our culture, that is personal. And for so many, you think, boy, that's talking about antiquated. In the New Testament, notice, 2 John 12, having many things to write to you, I do not want to do so with paper and ink, but I hope to come to you and speak face to face so that your joy may be made full. Look at the same thing in 3 John, verse 13. I had many things to write to you, but I'm not willing to write them to you with pen and ink, but I hope to see you shortly and we shall speak face to face. In other words, I've got something that's so important to tell you. I want to do it personally. I mean, weeks before I can tell you. But I'm willing to have that delay because it's so important to tell you face to face. See how things have changed? We say, man, personal letter, wow. But no, it's too important. I want to send an email. No. It's more important than that. I get it faster. I'm going to text it. I was in the phone store yesterday on the way to the airport. And one of our students, a guy about 30 or so, works there. So I like to talk with him when I go there. And we're talking about text messaging thing and so forth. He says he sends $1,200 a month. And he's the least in the store. He said, probably because I'm the oldest guy there. You know, that's, calculate that out, Stan. How many a day if you send $1,200 a month? You know, what is that, 40 a day? And he said, I'm the least. And he said, because we're actually talking about, my daughter wants that, you know, for her phone. And we're talking about different packages. I've got, you know, a deal like for $5 a month, I can send 300. I probably don't send 30. In a month, but I do use it. And he said, 300 sounds like a lot. He said, the average that I'm used to is 3,000 a month. I said, that's 100 a day. That's 100. How can you spend 100 text messages a day? I mean, just calculate the time. And these are people going to school, supposedly. Well, no wonder. You know, we're the land of the free and home of the stupid. If people are spending that much, they're not reading books and they're not studying and they're not, you know, learning anything. They're spending all their time doing this. In addition to email and internet time, I mean, that's just text messages. That's 100 a day, he says, is the average. Well, so if we're, that's, you know, personal to us because it's immediate. And the writers of the New Testament said, I'm willing to delay it. I don't want to do it with pen and ink because it's too important. I've got to tell you this face to face. Well, the point here is that even the Bible here affirms the importance of face to face communication. That when it comes to the things of God, face to face communication is important. That we can take advantage of all that technology. We can text and say, you know, I'll be home in 30 minutes. We can use all that to the glory of God. Let's, you know, we want to capture everything technology can give us for the sake of the kingdom, for the glory of God. Christians generally have been on the cutting edge of all technology for the sake of missions, particularly using all kinds of technology for Bible translation, you know, Wycliffe Bible translators and things like that, and transportation technology to get us into all languages, tongues, tribes, nations, peoples. So, we want to use all that for the glory of God. But realize there's an aspect of the Christian life called koinonia. And we live in a culture with all of its benefits takes us away from that. That there's something about face-to-face communication when you're talking about the things of God that matters. Yes. Well, exactly. I mean, a number of things.
We don't even know what to say to each other when we do get face-to-face because we aren't practicing saying anything meaningful.
Right. Well, and even written communication. I mean, when everything is, you know, you put IDK instead of I don't know, and you don't capitalize sentences. I mean, this has been brought out in the SAT exams. This is one of the reasons they've added the writing component, but they've said they can't read a lot of it. and, you know, they don't capitalize. I mean, I can see this grading papers, you know, on a master's level. So, I mean, even written communication is greatly hindered because of email and texting and so forth. So I think the best is, you know, to be good at all these things, to take advantage of all these things. But if you're too top-heavy in some of these, it really affects other ways that matter. That you're, yeah, what are you communicating? Just kind of snippets and sound bites, but nothing of substance. And you can't do it in a way that that lasts. If all you do is learn how to text and maybe a few emails, who's going to write books that are going to matter? Because that requires sustained thought, that requires meditation, that requires some depth, not just knowledge about a variety of things, not just kind of surface sort of communication, but where someone learns to express their thoughts well. You see this a lot during the Together for the Gospel conference a couple of years ago. We're about to have another one next month, but they had, and they're going to have one this time. Stan, you maybe you went to this. I don't know, but the band of bloggers, the people that gather together who have all these blogs, many of them well-known Christian blogs, and an administrator at our seminary was there, and he said, you know, he's kind of, these guys very well known, they're, you know, often critical, and what they say can influence a lot of people and so forth. He walked in the room, he thought, I was afraid of this. He said, it's the most socially withdrawn group of people I've ever seen in my life. You know, they were terrific. They could type well and communicate stuff online in a blog, but he said they were just blobs of dough. You know, they just, there was no personality there. That's always been true, that there are people who are better writers than speakers and conversationalists and all that. That's always been true. And so for someone who doesn't feel like they can speak very well, that's, there's still a great opportunity for influence and ministry through writing. And a lot of people who can preach or speak well can't write very well in terms of writing books and things like that. But increasingly, you have these socially withdrawn or socially ineffective people who all they can do is get on the internet. Well, there's more to life than that. We as Christians, we need to be more well-rounded. You know, you say, well, I can evangelize over the internet. Yes, that is true. But what about showing love and doing good deeds? See, you can't download a hug. And it makes a difference sometimes. You know, someone can put their hand on your shoulder when you can look in someone's eye, and it's different than when it is on a camera, on a webcam. You can't kiss somebody on the cheek. You know, you can't shake their hand firmly. You can't give a hug these other ways. And that's part of being a Christian, showing love. It's part of being in a family. I saw a cartoon. You saw this house. And in the corner room down there, which you presume to be the kitchen, says, tell your brother it's time for supper. And the little bubble comes out, tell your brother it's time for supper. And upstairs, a little bubble comes out, you've got mail. Of course, now it would be, you know, texting that. You know, that's just inadequate at best. We can use this and take advantage of it. There are places where it's greatly beneficial. But would that be the way Jesus would live? Would we want Jesus to be that way? So this koinonia must become a discipline. We must be intentional about saying, going to move out of this world and come face to face with people. In other words, let's get back to where we were before. There are experiences with Jesus you will not get unless you do that. There are ways Jesus will not bless you. There are ways Jesus will not interact with you except through the bodies of other people. See, the incarnation of Jesus, the theology of the incarnation has impact here. Jesus didn't just send messages in the sky. He could have. And in the Bible, sometimes it did. He you know, you've got these infinite number of stars. He could communicate with the stars, right? Has he ever done that before? Yes, Bethlehem. He could write with the calligraphy of the clouds, if he chose to do so, in the language of every tongue, tribe, nation, and people. Has he ever spoken through the clouds? Yes, this is my beloved Son, whom I'm well pleased. He could just lean over and go, hey, down there. Has he ever spoken from the sky? Yes, this is my beloved Son, whom I'm well pleased. He could do that. But what did he do? We read earlier, Hebrews, but a body you have ordained for me. Jesus came in person. And that has implications for our Christianity, that we have an embodied spirituality. It's not just about principles. It's not just about communicating information. But the incarnation has an impact upon being a Christian. There's an incarnate side to walking and being a Christian, living the Christian life, face to face, in person. Communicates more than we can otherwise. Christianity is not just transferring information from one hard drive to another. Let's move to this now. We've already, again, one thing builds upon another. We've already hinted at this, that these kind of gatherings, where before that we have gone, how do we conduct, how do we structure our meetings in such a way that when we come together, we feel love and are stimulated to be more loving. We experience good deeds from other people, and we are motivated to go and do more good deeds, to be more like Jesus. How can we have those kinds of meetings? Well, those kinds of meetings also encourage us, something we need all the more the closer we get to seeing the Lord. Let's remember our text. You know, the main point we've said is that don't forsake the assembling of yourselves together. That encapsulates all these one another's, all these spiritual disciplines. And that on either side, hinged on either side of that command, are these one another's. Consider how to stimulate one another to love and good deeds. Where does that happen? When we meet together in certain ways. Hinged on the other side now is this, but encouraging one another. How do you get the encouragement that you need? How does the Lord encourage you in ways that you need to stay faithful amid persecution, to stay faithful on campus, to stay faithful in your marriage, to stay faithful in what God has called you to do? Where do you get that kind of encouragement? To stay with it, to not quit the Christian life when your prayers aren't answered, when you're being persecuted, when you're disappointed with God. What encourages you to stay faithful? It's when we meet together in certain kinds of ways. Encouraging one another when we meet together in certain kinds of ways. Now, it was obvious that these people needed encouragement because of their persecution. And he said, the closer you get, as you see the day drawing near, in other words, the closer we get to the day when Jesus comes back or the day that we go see Jesus. As I look around the room, I can be pretty confident that the Lord is going to come back in at least 100 years. Or for most, 50 years. For you. Now, he may not bodily return to this earth for 1,000 years, for all I know, but as far as you're concerned, the Lord's return is going to be in the next 50, 75 years, or maybe much sooner. And as that day draws near, text tells us here we need more encouragement. Now, at first, that's kind of counterintuitive, isn't it? You think, look, as I know more about the Bible, as I have more Christian maturity, as I become spiritually stronger, you should need less encouragement, right? Well, in fact, the Bible says you need more. The older we get, sometimes the harder life gets. The more faithful, the more Christ-like you become, the harder the world, the flesh, and the devil often works against us. You may be more spiritually mature, but you have more responsibilities and other things that happen to you. As you get older, you accumulate responsibilities like barnacles. You know, when they're little like this, you know, you think, well, you got to feed them and dress them and all those kinds of things and clean them. But yet, there are times you can just, you know, put them down and just walk away because they're going to sleep a long time. You think, well, the older they get, I won't have to feed them anymore, and they can clean themselves and clothe themselves and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, but you have to start taking them to ball games and sit there for 3 hours at the ball game or at the recital. And in many ways, they actually take more time the older they get. And the more they come along, the more that is true. And as your body gets older, it begins to decay. Got bad news for many of you. Statistics are, on the average human being, 27, that's about the peak of your physical abilities. Then it begins to decline. That's why, you know, all the sports records are set by guys, generally, they're not set by guys in their 30s. It's guys in their 20s, late 20s. You don't see guys my age in the 100-meter dash in the Olympics, no matter how well they stay in shape. And until that time, every day of your life, you wake up, you're faster, you're stronger, you're bigger than you were the day before, and that's all you've known every day of your life. It's hard to imagine life being any different. But about 27 or 28, that begins to plateau, and then you begin to notice changes. And you can work hard to stay in shape and do all these things, but you're not going to, you can slow some things down, but you can't stop it. And then it becomes harder to do certain things spiritually than before. Yeah, I'm a professor of biblical spirituality. I've written 7 books in the area of spirituality. It is harder for me to maintain my devotional life now than it's ever been in my life. In part because I have more responsibilities. I get on 100 airplanes a year. And I have more, you know, burdens and responsibilities given to me because of those things. Which means it's more time. Which means it's harder then to practice the very things that put me in the positions and open the doors that I have now. And so I get more tired. I'm getting less sleep than I've ever gotten before. And so, you know, I need encouragement, perhaps as much as I've ever needed it in my life. Different kinds of encouragement sometimes. And so the closer we get to seeing the Lord, the more we need these kinds of meetings that I've talked about, which encourage us. And when the church gathers, we need that opportunity to talk to one another about things that matter. And so that people are discouraged can hear what God did for somebody else. And that encourages them. Maybe He'll do that for me. Maybe He'll answer prayer for me like that. And those that are encouraged can minister to those that are discouraged right now. But if you don't have those times where you talk about God and the things of God, if every meeting is just like this, where you're sitting looking at the back of someone's head and listening to one person talk, if that's the only kind of gatherings we have, that's the most important gathering we have, but if that's the only gathering we have, we are cutting ourselves off from so many blessings, including so many that would encourage us. We need to get together and learn to say things that matter and talk about them as though they do matter. At the end of the day, we all realize Auburn sports don't matter that much for eternity. You know, what about the big games 3 years ago? They don't matter. Nobody talks about them. You don't really care who played in the Super Bowl 2 years ago, 3 years ago. I mean, they're news at the moment. And it's fine to engage them at the moment. But let's talk about things that matter for eternity. Things that have the power to change your life. Whereas the one place we can expect to do that, it's at church. But we have to discipline ourselves more. We have fewer church meetings. Most of those are sit and listen meetings. We don't get to see other Christians that much in the culture. So it's so easy to neglect this. And the older you get, the more you need it. So we have to discipline ourselves. I am going to find a way. I'm going to find a time where we can talk about God and things of God. Talk about things that matter when we are together. Our times require this. We work harder than any generation ever has had to do this. Augustine, that great 4th century theologian, talked about what he loved, about the encouragement that comes from real Christian fellowship, real koinonia. He said, I love the talk, the laughter, the courteous little gestures toward one another, the sharing of the study of books. the companionship that was sometimes serious and sometimes hilariously nonsensical. That wasn't what you expected from a great theologian, was it? He said, real life together sometimes hilariously nonsensical. The differences of opinion that left no more bad feeling than if a man were disagreeing with his own self. The rare disputes that simply seasoned the normal consensus of agreement. These things become more precious to you the closer you get to seeing the Lord. They really do. But the closer you get to seeing the Lord, sometimes the more you get weary of the battle. Physical weariness tends to give way to spiritual weariness and say, I'm just tired of fighting for 30 years, 35 years, abortion. I'm just tired of fighting certain issues all the time. I'm just tired of so many struggles. I see men, especially as they get older, they seem to compromise long defended theology. You think they're compromising on things that 20 years ago they would have died for. What happened? Sometimes you just get tired of the battle as you get older. Some get cynical. You be around a church long enough and you have high expectations because you say this is a good church, a faithful church, and then you see people sometimes treat you worse than the world does. And you see people who don't always live up to their Christian profession. And it can be disillusioning. And when you see that decade after decade, you can be cynical and become hardened. And you see ministers fall. You see Christian leaders fall. And it's easy to become cynical about the things of God and about the church. And so despite spiritual maturity, the load is so much heavier than ever before. You need more encouragement than ever before. But the temptation is, well, as I'm getting older, it's hard to get to church. I'm more tired. I've got more responsibilities than I had before. So when am I going to make time for all these meetings? We have to discipline ourselves. To say, I need that. My soul needs that. If anyone ever knew what good fellowship was, it would have been Esther Edwards Burr. She was the daughter of Jonathan and Sarah Edwards. In their time, the Edwards, as most ministers did in those times, their home was often like an inn and often like a seminary. And ministerial students would come and sometimes stay for 6 months in the Edwards home. And so, and homes weren't as big as they are in our day. And Edwards had 11 children, 10 daughters and a son, 11 remarkable children. One of them married a man who would become president at Princeton Seminary. This is Esther Edwards Burr. And they didn't sit around surfing the internet while their parents were talking with these guests about the things of God either. They would all be there and they would hear conversation about things that matter. And she wrote one time to a friend of hers about a recent time of fellowship. And she said, oh my dear, how charming it is to sit and hear such excellent persons converse on the experimentals, or we'd say today the experiential things of religion. I esteem, she said, religious conversation. Koinonia, talking about God and the things of God. I esteem religious conversations one of the best helps to keep up religion in the soul, to encourage us. Accepting secret devotion, I don't know but the very best. Then what a lamentable thing that 'tis so neglected by God's own children. How lamentable indeed. Well, on your handout, we're going to look at this application part. Now, I'm going to do the first part of this, and we're going to take our last break. First, I want to apply this to church leaders. Now, that can be everything from the pastors, deacons, teachers, small group leaders, team leaders of various type, any sort of leader within the church. Recognize, first of all, that good leadership does not view koinonia as supplemental to the health of a church, but essential. This is not something you just add on. Packer puts it this way, we should not think of our fellowship with other Christians as a spiritual luxury. Fellowship is a spiritual necessity, for God has made us in such a way that our fellowship with Himself is fed by our fellowship with other believers. The better the koinonia, the better the church. The better the koinonia, the better the church. Second, good leadership does not presuppose koinonia, it cultivates it. Don't assume that because the members of the church are in the same room that koinonia is happening. It's probably just socializing in most cases that's happening. In its place, that's fine. When I pastored in the Chicago area, we stopped calling our monthly after-church meetings fellowships. We called them socials. That's pretty much what they were. Went the old name. We wouldn't have ice cream fellowships anymore. We had ice cream socials because most of what happened was socializing. And in its place, that's fine. We wanted to provide a place for that. A family needs to socialize, to talk about news, weather, sports, work, and these kinds of things. But we also need to cultivate koinonia, especially in this culture, because it happens much less than we think, especially at church. So you have to have those consideration times, which are actually fun. But what can we do to cultivate people talking to each other about God and about the things of God? To talk about Christian books they've read, to give testimonies. What can we do to cultivate that happening in this church? Lots of meetings don't ensure lots of koinonia. You can get people together a lot, but they may do nothing but talk about news, weather, sports, work, and family. One of the reasons why leaders often neglect koinonia is because they really and rightly understand the importance of teaching. We get together so little. The greatest need today is the preaching and teaching of the Word of God. And so I'm going to squeeze every opportunity we have together. In the few opportunities we do have together, I'm going to squeeze out every possibility to teach. Well, that's a good motivation. But realize that koinonia has a teaching function. You can teach through koinonia. One of the two most, I think, important things I ever teach, both in churches, conferences like this, and in my classes, I did this week, when I talk about praying through Scripture. And one of the things I always do and tell them, if you go teach this somewhere else, you be sure and do this. After I give them a chance to try it, to go out and pray, when we come back, I say, now, how did it go? And I stimulate conversation, testimonies, where people talk about their experience in the last few minutes of praying through Scripture. And there's a teaching that goes on there as we teach one another. And then I take advantage of that. And we'll comment on their testimonies. I always get the same kinds of things. It's a more God-centered way of praying. It's like a real conversation with a real person. And it helps me stay focused and my mind didn't wander and these sorts of things. I prayed about things I normally don't pray about. And I will then piggyback on those testimonies and teach. So don't overlook the teaching potential of koinonia. One of the ways that we used to do this in our church in Illinois, I think, looking back in 15 years of ministry there, other than our worship services, it was the most important ministry that we had. One Sunday night a month, we had evening services, and one Sunday night a month, we met in homes. But the other three Sunday nights, we'd meet at the church building, and one of those, we would have a meeting after church that we called a fellowship / theological discussion meeting. And we used to have tongue-in-cheek contests about renaming it, because even just to put the headline in the bulletin went all the way across, you know, the bulletin. In other words, we were going to have a discussion meeting. What were we going to talk about? Well, it's going to be a fellowship meeting. But to make sure people knew that what we meant by that, we were going to talk about God and the things of God, we called it a fellowship / theological discussion meeting. It was kind of a cumbersome title, but we wanted people to know what we were talking about. Later on, a few years later, I read Richard Baxter's The Reformed Pastor, and he had a meeting that he called the very same thing with one word different. So I didn't feel so bad about it being cumbersome then. But one Sunday night a month, and we'd finish the evening service about 7:15 or so, people were to drive down the street about a mile to a big house where those who were interested would meet and gather. We had it at that house because the woman who lived there was one of the biggest sponges theologically in the church. She had two little kids. If we met at any other house, she'd have to leave at 9 o'clock and couldn't stay for as much of it as she wanted. So we'd go to her house. It was nearby, pretty good-sized house, and only the most interested people would go. So the hungriest people in the church were the ones who attended. By the time I usually talked to people, got out of there and got to the place, it was usually 8 o'clock. And so they knew that by 8 o'clock, everyone was to be seated, clothed in the right mind, and have their snacks in hand. Now, the only food we allowed was something in a bag or something, no cooking. We didn't want anybody to say, well, I can't go tonight. We didn't fix anything. The only most cooking we allowed was microwave popcorn. So if everyone brought chips, all we had to eat were chips. If everyone brought cookies, we only had cookies to eat. But we would have snacks. They'd be seated and have their snacks in their hand. And at 8 o'clock, then I would come and start the discussion. I had four levels of prepared questions. First question was, any questions about today's sermons? You know, they heard 45, 50-minute messages with no chance to ask questions, really. Did any questions arise? Yeah, how does this apply to a single mom? Gosh, you know, I didn't even think about that. Or did you really mean to say we could lose our salvation? No, I meant just the opposite. Boy, am I glad I had a chance to clear that up, you know. When do people have a chance to ask those kinds of questions? Second question was, any questions about any of the sermons since we did this a month ago? It's been 4 weeks. You may have heard me Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night, several times since then. We're going through several different sermon series. Any questions that have arisen about those? Let me come back to the third one. The fourth question was, I came with some prepared questions about current events, usually. And only once in all the years we did this did I have to go to level four. Because we spent all of our time usually on level three. And level three question was, after I'd gone through the ones about sermons, any questions about your Bible reading, Christian books you've been reading, something you heard on Christian radio, TV recordings? And that's where people had questions. Because everybody has questions about the Bible, about the Christian life. But when do you have an opportunity to ask them? We all have them. I mean, if I had an hour with Dr. Moeller, for example, I have a lot of questions I'd love to ask him. And you have those questions. You have a lot of questions I'm sure that you'd love, you know, if you had just an hour to ask questions of your pastoral staff. You probably wouldn't have any trouble coming up with those. And everybody has them. But when do we have a chance to ask them? You say, well, after church, we'd be happy to do that. I know they would say that. Yeah, but, you know, there's a crowd. Other people have things to talk to you about. Or I've got to get home. You say, well, during the week, come have lunch with you anytime during the week. Yeah, but I don't have the questions then. You know, or I feel like I'm intruding upon your time or whatever. So we had an opportunity where people could ask their questions with all the time they wanted. People who would get upset if the evening service went 10 minutes too long would stay till midnight if they got to ask their questions. I can still see times when people, this woman would push us out of her house sometimes at 1 in the morning, say, you people have got to go home. We got to go to bed. People would stay that long because they got to talk about things that matter. The Holy Spirit compelled them to want to talk and hear about the things of God. And here was a chance to hear about them, and not just general teaching, which has its place, certainly, the most important place, but here's a chance that I can ask the questions I have right now. That, yeah, I read this thing I was reading in Samuel, and this medium, Saul comes to this medium, and she brings up the spirit of Samuel. Was that really Samuel? What was going on there? Well, Brother Paul will be happy to answer that question after this meeting. After I'm gone, actually. But when do we get to talk about those things? Or I read this book, and I'm not sure about this. Or I saw this Benny Hinn guy on TV, and looks like all these people are getting healed. Is that for real? I guarantee you, the size of church that you have on Sunday morning, I bet you there's at least one person wondering that. People who are thinking, you know, it's kind of weird, but it seems like the power of God is happening there. I'd be willing to give up my theology to experience the power of God like that. Is that for real? What's going on there? When do people get to ask those questions? And if they don't do it here, who are they going to ask? Who do you want to ask? Some theological weirdo they work with? No, you want the people of this church's questions to be answered within the loving doctrinal understanding of this church family. But when do we provide that opportunity? For people to talk at length about their questions about God and the things of God. So that was really the heart of that meeting. Come together tonight. We're going to talk about God and the things of God. Not socializing. We're going to fellowship. I can still see people sitting two by two up the stairs in this house. It was a house where the family room where we were would sweep around into the dining room and then into the kitchen. There'd be a wall between the kitchen and the family room. And people standing in the kitchen. They couldn't see, but just to hear. Then at 9 o'clock, I would read a page from Spurgeon's Morning and Evening, brief kind of closing devotional, and dismiss those who had little kids and needed to go home, or somebody who just they couldn't stay for the whole thing, and that was sort of a formal break. Then everyone else would remount, reload on the snacks, and come back. We'd have at it again, sometimes till midnight, 1 in the morning, because it was stimulating. They got questions answered, and I wasn't always like the answer man. I would guide the discussion. Well, what do you think about that? What's your view of that? What do you think the Bible teaches about that? And if someone asked a question, I clearly remember one where someone asked about basically baptismal regeneration. One of our deacons had come out of that kind of background. I said, well, Andy, you've wrestled with that more than anyone here. Why don't you answer that for us? It was koinonia, people teaching one another, people encouraging one another. How did this encouragement happen? When we met together in certain kind of ways where we experienced the riches of Christian community. We could experience the riches of what God had taught this guy that he hadn't taught the rest of us in the same way. We could experience the riches of what this woman was struggling with and how she had the Lord minister to her. We could experience the riches of what God had done in all of our midst and not just in one person's life and study. Give one other illustration of this much more briefly. When we did have our Sunday evening services, since I believe, as we talked about last night, I believe the Lord's Day is to be the day we're to worship. I believe we can worship 7 days a week if we want, but there's one day we must worship, and that's the Lord's Day. But having our Lord's Day worship, I think if we meet again, we're free to do something like that or something unlike that. I don't think if we meet together, it has to be another worship service. It might be more just kind of music. It might be more just testimonies. It may be something else, and sometimes a blend. So we would have basically an evening worship service, but I would pause at a certain point and just walk down kind of in front of the first pew, and I would say, who has something to share with the church family tonight? But I never left it as open-ended as that, because that's so broad, it's kind of hard for people to think. Sometimes they need hooks to put their thoughts on. So I might say, who's got a prayer request to share with us tonight? Who's got a testimony? Maybe some answered prayer. Who's got something else you want us to know, you want to tell the whole church body, or something else you just want to share with us? And somebody might say, our grandbaby was born. Well, the people in her Sunday school class all knew that because she had told them that this morning, but the rest of us didn't know that. And we need to know that if we're going to be a family. We need to know that if we're going to rejoice with her. So when do we have the opportunity to hear about that? Well, we structured opportunities. Sometimes that went 5 minutes. Sometimes it went 30 minutes. Sometimes I adapted my preaching based upon that koinonia time. I wouldn't have done that on a Sunday morning. But that was an opportunity for koinonia. And we let the Holy Spirit have free reign in that regard and give people the opportunity to encourage one another in that way. Well, we're going to take one more break here, and when we come back, we're going to pick up there with some questions you can use to stimulate one another in loving good deeds. Koinonia, let me put it this way. If you look on the back, there are koinonia cultivating questions. You might want to take advantage of some of those even right now. Let me just say that on this table back here, I've got a copy of my newsletter, which I send out every 6 or 8 weeks. That's a sample, so don't take it. But there's a sign-up sheet there if you'd like to get that. It's free. We don't ask for money. You won't get more junk email. But you just need to put your name and email address there for that. So let's take a 10 or 15-minute break.
Thank you for listening. Grace Heritage Church meets in Auburn, Alabama, Services are held at 9:30 a.m. on Sunday morning at the Best Western on the corner of College and University.